Underworld. Disc 18.
August 14th, 1964. The charismatic Black stood outside the church talking to the crowd. Downtown, the young whites leaned on brick walls and parked cars, crew-cut young men in chinos or jeans, or squatted on the curbstone, some older men among them, mostly showing a small, hard, salty grin, eyes tight, watching the marchers move out of the bus terminal. Past the brick dorms and athletic fields of the campus, a group of Black men lounged against a car parked in front of a rickety frame house in an alley off Lynch Street. A man with a cane, a man with blue suspenders, a man in a necktie and white shirt and straw fedora. A couple of younger men sitting on the fenders and talking to a woman eating a peach on the porch steps. The charismatic speaker said, "They made us run, so we got good at it." The marchers came into town carrying knapsacks and signs. Some of them walked toward the campus as the sun began to set. A number of white-shirted police stood along the route, smoking, some of them, and seeming to disregard the marchers, who walked in two loose columns toward the sound of the speaker's voice. The young speaker said, "They made us run until we got so good at it, we didn't need their inspiration anymore." In the Greyhound terminal, a number of marchers separated from the others and began to sit on the floor of the whites-only waiting room. But the porch didn't really have steps. It had a couple of loose cinder blocks set against the brick underpinning, and that's where the woman sat. Students joined the crowd in front of the church, listening to the speaker, and some of the corner boys came out of Cooper's, where they'd been shooting pool, and stood around to watch the crowd. Men and women kept marching through the downtown streets, and the whites sat on the curbstone and watched them, seemingly unable to stop grinning. Four highway patrolmen stood outside the bus terminal, leaning on a cruiser and talking casually, the butt ends of their shotguns leveraged on their hips, muzzles pointing up. The young speaker said, "But just about the time we became Olympic-class runners, some of us decided we were going to sit down." The woman finished eating the peach and held the pit in her hand. And when one of the men leaning on a car fender said something racy or tricky or sly, she threw the pit at his feet with a kind of dismissive motion. Somebody adjusted the speaker's microphone, and his voice began to carry now, reaching the guardsmen who were coming down out of trucks at the end of a blocked-off street. A Black woman stood watching in the bus terminal. She'd come from up north, riding buses all the way. And now she was in the terminal, fittingly, about to sit on the floor. She watched local police move among the demonstrators and lift a young man by an arm and leg, taking him in two directions briefly at once, until they got straightened out. A pair of short-sleeved cops, not looking at the youngster, who sat unstruggling in their grip as they carried him out to the street. The charismatic Black said, "There's a certain feeling circulating in the culture that Black people ought to develop a willingness to die." The guardsmen formed up and began to fix bayonets, and their commander stood nearby in summer tans and a campaign hat, looking around for the armored van. The mic'd voice floated over the heads of the assembled marchers and students and townspeople. On the floor of the bus terminal, the woman waited for the police to reach her and carry her out to the truck and take her to the jail. One Rose Meriwether Martin, known as Rosie, an insurance adjuster from New York City. "The interesting thing is that this here's not what the white man is saying. It's what the Negro is saying. If they want to kill us, in other words, let's develop a willingness to die. Or was saying, because we damn well ain't saying it anymore." There was an armored van moving through the streets, with bulletproof windows and gun ports, and the men inside had submachine guns and tear gas launchers. The young whites began moving away from the walls and the parked cars. They got up from the curbstone and dusted off their pants, and they went to stand at the far end of the street, uninterested in the marchers now, or interested in a different way. The woman on the porch saw some young men running in the dark, corner boys or students looking back as they ran. And the men lounging against the parked car also saw them, but did not stiffen or speak or move away. It was their car, their street, and they needed to measure the situation. The young black man said, "I ain't saying don't resist. I ain't saying assume the fetal position and let them put their cocked revolvers upside your head. Tell you what I'm saying." The whites didn't look at the marchers as people coming into town to agitate and make trouble. Not anymore. They stopped reading the signs about voter rights and freedom rides. They stopped grinning at white nuns marching with black ministers. It was the armored van they were interested in now. 23 feet long, searchlights blazing. "And I ain't saying you're obliged to love those truncheons they're beating you with." They watched it go by and began to follow it, some of them, vaguely. The guardsmen wore standard-issue helmets and were putting on gas masks now, and the troopers outside the bus terminal wore white ridged helmets that resembled construction hard hats. Rosie Martin watched them get closer, local police in pairs scooping up the demonstrators and taking them out to flatbed trucks. Blacks with shirt tails flying, looking back as they ran, and maybe the woman on the porch could smell a burning in the air. The gas masks were bulky devices with goggle eyes and swollen nose pieces. The guardsmen looked insect-eyed, stepping into a floodlit area near the black college campus. The masks had flap mouths and filtration chambers that bulged out of the left side like pineapple tins. A man lay spread-eagle outside the terminal, being patted down by troopers. A man was being tug-of-warred. A young black in a striped shirt, two guardsmen gripping an arm and a leg, and a marcher holding the other leg and trying to pull him back into the crowd outside Mount Calvary Church. Somebody threw a bottle, and the woman on the porch heard it break in the street. She stood up and tried to see what was happening in the dark out there. Voices, people running, people coming this way and then turning back. "Tell you what I'm saying. I'm saying there's nothing in the world to worry about, despite the evidence all around you. Because any time you see black and white together, you know they are joined in some effort of betterment. Says so in the Constitution." Another bottle broke. And in the terminal, Rosie Martin saw them drag a woman out the door, face down and head first. The guardsmen moved into the crowd outside the church, holding their bayoneted rifles at port arms, and the gas came blowing in behind them. In the terminal, a cop started clubbing people on the arms and legs. Rosie watched him calmly, counting the number of sit-in marchers before he got to her. The charismatic speaker said, "They're spraying. I'm talking. I'm going to keep on talking as long as I got a larynx that can function. Black people love to rap," he said. The marchers sat down. They scattered. Some entered the church, some ran the other way, and the guardsmen dragged others along the ground toward the barricaded street. At the terminal, the cops had their billy clubs out and were moving in a stoop among the demonstrators, who sat hunched forward with their arms over their heads. The gas rolled through the streets, scorching people's eyeballs, making their eyeballs feel sucked out by the heat. The streets were filled with running men and women. The gas rolled in, and they strayed down alleys, feeling their way, chests tight, coughing in spasms, or chose to walk, some of them, shambling half-blind toward the church. Rosie knew she'd be taken off to jail in a flatbed garbage truck, and then put in a crowded cell and given a piss-smelling mattress, because this had been the scuttlebutt for days. Blacks came running down the dark street, and the men who'd been lounging against the car began to stir, finally. The man with blue suspenders went into a frame house, and the man with a straw hat got into the car and rolled up the windows, and then got out again. And the other men slid off the fenders and went to stand on the porch, where the woman stood looking down the street. Women wanted the same prison conditions the men got. This was a definite issue. Guardsmen massed around the armored van, insect-headed, and look down the dark alleys for students throwing rocks, or men out of the bars, the juke joints, still holding cans of Colt 45. And they heard the speaker say, "It's all a question of mind over matter. They don't mind, and we don't matter." Rosie was dragged on her ass out into the street and spun around on her britches and left there. She spotted sawhorse barricades and police cruisers, people milling and scuffling, and photographers popping flash cubes, and she thought she caught the first taste of gas. People stagger-ran toward the church through ranks of guardsmen. She saw the one-legged man on crutches, a familiar figure over weeks of bus rides and marches across state lines, and the man being beaten. She saw a slim man being struck by a cop with a billy club, hit 3-4 times, a pause, then hit again, white eyes showing. The woman on the porch felt the air burning and went inside, and the men went inside with her. Young men went running past, students and marchers, and one of them stopped long enough to fling a bottle the other way. The gas, called CS, made people dizzy almost at once, and caused a stinging on the body where the skin was moist. Rosie smelled the gas. She tasted it before she saw it. A trooper had a man bent over the trunk of the cruiser in an arm lock, and another trooper stood nearby holding 2 shotguns, his own and his partner's, who had the arm lock on the marcher. The armored van moved slowly through the streets, searchlights swiveling on the roof. The church was filling up with people trying to escape the gas, which rolled through the alleys off Lynch Street in Jackson, Mississippi, on a muggy summer night, with radios playing and children standing at the windows of shotgun shacks watching men run through the dark. Rosie started running. She saw the cop beating the man methodically, 3-4 blows and then a pause, and she started running toward them. The gas had a radiance, a night glow, and the men in insect masks came walking out of the cloud, alive and bright. The man who'd rolled up the windows of the car, a 60-year-old in a white shirt and straw hat, proceeded to walk down the unpaved street toward his house, tasting the gas and putting his hat over his face and accidentally kicking a pop bottle someone had thrown, lying unbroken in the dust. She watched the cop strike the man on the head and arms, 3-4 blows with his billy club, and then a pause, and she pushed through a couple of sawhorses and ran directly toward them, feeling fast and light and unstoppable. The gas rolled through the streets in tides and drifts, narrowing down alleys and fitting into confined spaces. She had no idea what she planned to do when she got there. About 4 seconds from now. December 19th, 1961. Charles Wainwright was on the phone to a client in Omaha, soothing, stroking, joking, making promises he couldn't keep. He felt a measure of detachment from the matters at hand, his eyes slightly aswim in the agreeable yield of a long, liquid lunch. He heard himself saying, "Off the top of my head, I would estimate, Duane, we'll be able to present this campaign, time-wise, in 4.5 weeks. 4 weeks minimum. We just switched our best art director to the account. 3 weeks with heavenly intervention. God keeps an apartment in New York, incidentally, because this is a swingin' town. Seriously, the guy's an award-winning art director, and he's in his office right now doing roughs." Just then Pasqualini, the art director, stuck his head in the door. "What is death?" he said. Wainwright smiled and shrugged. "Nature's way of telling you to slow down." Charlie tossed his head to indicate laughter, and Pasqualini headed down the hall to tell the joke to some of the other senior account men. Charlie's peers, the guys with the snap-tab collars and chromium smiles. They drank Gibson's straight up and said, "Thanks much." In fact, Charlie thought the joke was beautifully suited to these surroundings. In the Times every morning, wasn't it a fact that the obits and the ad column tended to appear on facing pages? Charles Wainwright was an account supervisor at Parmalee, Lockhart, and Keown, a medium-sized agency located in the Fred F. French Building on Fifth Avenue in New York. The shop had suffered a few setbacks lately, and every time an account went walking out the door, a hush fell over the carpeted halls. People stood in line at the coffee wagons, holding their poignant mugs. The jokes they told had a bitter edge. Executives made phone calls behind closed doors. The paste-up boys sat in the bullpen with the radio off and the lights down low. Copywriters took three-hour lunches and came back stinko. They sat in their cubicles and stared at memos pinned to the corkboard, wondering why they'd sold out, if this was how it felt to be a sellout. Charlie had to fire people sometimes. Once he fired three people in one day, two before lunch and one after. He fired a tall man and a short man in the same week. These were the Mutt and Jeff firings. He fired a man recovering from a heart attack, and a woman who just died. He didn't know Maxine was dead, and he was forced to fire the secretary who'd caused the mix-up. Charlie said into the phone, "If you want us to do the presentation here, I'll get you a table at the Four Seasons, Duane, and you can play footsie with my English secretary. Or I'll schlep the layouts out to Omaha. What a thrill it is to spend time. No, seriously. What do you do on Sundays, Duane? Go to the park and look at the cannon?" This was a line off a Lenny Bruce LP, but Charlie didn't think he had to credit the source. He liked Duane Sturmer, a decent guy for an ad manager. And the account was fairly sound. The lawn fertilizer division of a giant chemical company. The creative types here in the shop wanted to do a bomb-your-lawn campaign. A little twist on the fact that these fertilizer ingredients, plus fuel oil, could produce a rather loud disturbance if ignited. A young copywriter, Swayze, stuck his head in the door. "Had a date with a Swedish model last night." Charlie smiled and waited. The kid paused for effect. "When I touched her Volvo, she sobbed." It was Charlie who killed the Bomb Your Lawn campaign while it was still in-house. The creative types wanted to use George Metesky as a spokesman, an approach so suicidal, Charlie found it somewhat lovable. George Metesky was the mad bomber of the 1940s and 1950s, famous for setting off a series of blasts at New York landmarks. They wanted to track him down at the state pen or the funny farm and build the whole campaign around his ancient and fabled deeds and his endorsement of the product. "Bomb your lawn with Nitrotex." Mad Ev was getting younger all the time, and Charlie was 46, almost ready to be placed on an ice floe with his handcrafted English wingtips and his Patek Philippe timepiece. Still, he had solid accounts and a sunlit corner office with a crushed leather sofa. Prints of steeplechase races and frocked lordlings riding to hounds. A painted sea chest he'd spotted in a London shop. And the thing that gave him away as a regular guy, a sort of baseball shrine. Three populist mementos clustered at the far end of the room. First, a 10th anniversary limited edition lithograph entitled "The Shot Heard Round the World." The piece included photos of the polo grounds, Ralph Branca delivering the pitch, Bobby Thompson swinging the bat, Thompson's teammates waiting in a conga line to greet him at home plate. Second, a photo of Thompson and Branca standing on a golf course with Dwight D. Eisenhower, all holding drivers, a couple of Secret Service men shadowing the fringes of the picture. Charlie's wife found the item in a junk shop in Vermont. And third, a smudged baseball, balanced on the rim of a coffee mug that sat on the credenza. A ball he'd bought from a guy who claimed it was the very object Branca had hurled and Thompson had heroically struck. His secretary walked in, Sandy, in a Mondrian dress and white shoes. "Duane, my secretary just walked in. She's wearing white shoes. She's got a foot fetish and she's dying to meet you." He liked to tease Duane, who was a bachelor, extremely shy, a large, flesh-colored man in a pajama-striped wash-and-wear suit and shoes like Chinese gunboats. Sandy dropped some status reports in his inbox. He listened to Duane talk about ad rates and cost per thousand. Sandy walked out of the office, and he watched her, buttocks swinging meanly, printed with yellow parallelograms. They'd wanted to give George Metesky a wig, a mustache, and spectacles to make him look like Einstein. These creative minds with their sublimated forms of destruction. Every third campaign featured some kind of play on weapons. The agency was still in shock over the Equinox oil campaign. This was a very expensive effort that culminated in a 60-second commercial shot in the Jornada del Muerto in remotest New Mexico. Site of the first atomic test shot ever made. A white space on the map. Totally closed to the public. Charlie thought the idea would fly, actually. Fill up two cars with premium gasoline. One with Equinox, the other with a leading competitive brand. Run the cars across the barren desert. Shoot the commercial with helicopters, crane shots, tracking shots, slow motion, stop action, all the latest know-how. White car versus black car. Clear implication, U.S. versus USSR. First car to get to the Trinity site wins. This is the monument that marks the spot where the bomb went off. We get permission from the Department of Energy, Department of Defense, Atomic Energy Commission, National Park Service. We shoot the thing. Takes many weeks, costs per second more than a Hollywood epic. But it'll fly, baby. The stark scrub, the heat undulations and cow skulls, the dust storms, the high-angle shots, one car pulling away, the other catching up. A voiceover done by a pompous announcer with a Cold War tone. Which car will run out of gas first? Which one will get to the marker? Miles per gallon, a huge consumer issue. Of course, the white car outlasted the black car and reached the site first. We air the commercial. Heavy schedule. We thought the Soviet embassy might lodge a complaint. We looked forward to it. Free publicity. What happens? We get complaints, all right, but not from foreign governments. We hear from the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. We hear from the Urban League. We hear from the Congress of Racial Equality, because the white car beat the black car. An amazing firestorm of protest. Threatened boycotts of all Equinox products. We pull the commercial. We reshoot the entire thing and absorb the cost ourselves. Two cars, both white. Car with letter A painted on roof. Car with letter B painted on roof. Lesson? Don't mix your metaphors. Cost per thou, Duane, is an overrated device intended to blind us to the truth of our situation. He waited for Duane to ask what the truth of our situation was. There is only one truth. Whoever controls your eyeballs runs the world. There were probably 24 people walking the streets in the days after the game, shysters, heisters, fools, and knaves, all claiming they had the one and only baseball. Which Charlie devoutly wanted to believe was the self-same object on his credenza. Yes, the baseball that marked him as a regular fellow, with a soft streak, despite his milled steel veneer. He got fascist haircuts done by Spadavecchia of Milan. His school, actually, since Gianni was frequently overbooked. He wore striped shirts with white collars, or white shirts with blue collars. He wore suits so compulsively custom-fit, a fart would split a seam. He played squash and handball, did Canadian Air Force exercises, applied bronzing agents to his face and body, and sat in front of a sun lamp all winter long. A regular guy with a station wagon heart, despite the giddy MG he'd just treated himself to, perfect for tooling the foothills of the Berkshires around their weekend place. A sentimental, weepy, white guy. Yes, the baseball he dearly wanted to entrust to his son, Chucky, to Charles Jr. No longer the bubblegum boy of yore, but a failed preppy now, slant-bodied and dissonant, with dumb, dumb eyes and a way of hating you from a distance. Flunked out of Exeter, chased out of Choate, walked out of Andover. Chucky didn't care. But Charlie did, and it was painful. How could he give such an emotional object, whatever ambiguity throbbed in the ball's corked heart, to this aimless, wayward, aging kid, a displaced person in his own life. Pasqualini stuck his head in the door on his way back to the art department.
What do you call a 6'5", 260-pound Negro that you run into in a dark alley?
Charlie smiled thinly, wary of the new wave of civil rights jokes, and raised his head to indicate what?
Mister.
He fired a pregnant woman once. He fired a man related to the Dutch royal family. He fired a Catholic, a Protestant, and a Jew in fairly close succession. He fired a man for falling in the water on the company boat ride, and another for carrying a gun to a client meeting. They're doing research, Duane, on what they call retinal discharge. They secretly photograph women in supermarkets. They have sensitive cameras hidden on the shelves that record excitations of the inner eye, motions of the eye far more subtle and telling than a simple blink. And it seems that women go completely crazy, eyeball-wise, when they see certain colors, packages, and designs. These are orgasms, basically, of the eye, the brain, and the nervous system. How do we use this research? Simple. We correlate high-discharge events with the particular items that cause them, and then we design our products and packaging accordingly. Once we get the consumer by the eyeballs, we have complete mastery of the marketing process.
Sandy came back in and began to mouth some sort of complicated message.
But if Charlie truly believed the baseball was authentic, would he leave it in plain sight, unguarded, where a cleaning woman might decide to take it home to her kid because she doesn't earn enough money to buy him a baseball? Or a delivery boy from the coffee shop around the corner? He pictured a swarthy male drifting through the corridors on a slow afternoon with creamless coffee and a toasted English in a white bag, looking for something to pinch.
She wants to talk to us, Duane.
Yes, my secretary.
Did I ever tell you how she types? She likes to fold one leg up under her. Before she began sitting on her foot, she did about 25 words a minute. Now she does 200.
Charlie was fascinated by certain quirks and traits that Sandy brought to her job. She had that distinctively English quality of looking terrifically fresh and crisp, even while conveying tawdry intimations of the state of her underwear, and the fact that she bathes only under pressure from her roommates, Fiona and Georgina. Charlie talked to Omaha and deciphered his secretary's mouthed message at the same time.
She's telling us she needs to leave early, Duane. She's been leaving early quite often lately and taking conspicuously long lunches. We know what that means, don't we? An affair with a married man.
Sandy did a stand-up collapse, aghast at the man's cheek, his temerity, his effrontery, his American fucking New York nerve. Charlie gave her his Richard Widmark grin. He had no reason to keep her around the rest of the afternoon, but asked her to order him an orange juice before she left. Charlie wanted to pitch the Minute Maid account. He thought about orange juice all the time. He looked at it, drank it, had fantasies about it. He knew how to advertise orange juice. Forget Florida, forget the piddling vitamins. You have to go for appetite appeal, for the visual hit, because this is a beautiful and enticing beverage. And women's eyeballs reach high levels of excitation when they see bright orange cans in the freezer gleaming with rime ice. You have to show the pulp. You show the juice splashing in the glass. You show the froth on a perky housewife's upper lip, like the hint of a blowjob before breakfast. Of course, there is no pulp in concentrate, and there is only a micro-trace of pulp in container juice. But you can suggest, you can make inferences, you can promise the consumer the experience of citrusy bits of real pulp. A glass of juice, a goblet brimming with particulate matter, like wondrous orange smog. You show it, you photograph it lovingly and microscopically. If the can or package can be orgasmically visual, so can the product inside. There was nothing Charlie liked better than a glass of orange juice on a lazy Sunday morning in the country, nicely spiked with vodka. He wanted to pitch the Smirnoff account. There was an element of Russian chic in the culture these days. Ivetyshenko in his black market jeans. Those Russian hats that sprouted earlier this winter, still going strong in New York and Chicago. Astrakhan's. You wake up one morning, and every third man earning a salary in a certain range is wearing a lambskin Russian hat. Duane, she's gone, good buddy. We've lost her to some lech in the copy department. I'll bet anything on that. Sandy thinks writers are moody and glamorous because they're always in danger of getting canned. The moans of spewing buses rose into the settling dusk. The office lights were on now, and all up and down the halls the girls tapped on the squarish keys of their IBM Selectrix. The graved ball kissed the ribbon kissed the paper, a superior grade of bond that was rag-weaved, like the Oxford shirts worn by the bosses of the typing girls. Every 16 seconds one of them hit the wrong key and muttered a middling curse. The married copywriters met their secretaries, or the secretaries of other writers, or the tall and lissome secretaries of account executives, white-shod and well-spoken, and went about the tender regimen of their lunchtime love. The nooner, it was called, or the matinee, meeting in the secretaries' snug apartments, striking in their dimensional similarity to the cubicles the writers worked in, only decorated more touchingly and vulnerably with posters of Madrid on the off-white walls, or prints of Marino Marini horses or Bernard Buffet lobsters, or in the larger apartments of secretaries with roommates, which complicated the schedule and made the writers yearn for an intimate glimpse of one of the roommates, barefoot in a partially open robe, perhaps, coming from the shower after a late night with a failed date. The apartment situated nearly always in the sunless hindquarters of white brick buildings in the East 80s. Undoormanned, the small elevators inspected every 2 years by an individual called A. Bear, according to recent entries on the record of inspection that was fixed to the elevator walls. And yes, it's true, Charlie has practiced this kind of erotic disport himself, off and on, with one or another single young woman working in the production department or some such level of the mothership. Below decks and lonesome, and not always, actually, very young. But did he enjoy these interludes, or were they sad entertainments he inflicted on himself in the stark space of a convertible sofa turned open to span the room so that he had to walk upon the bedding to go and pee? He had lovely sex with his wife in an antique bed with carved oak posts. So what are you doing here, Charlie? Bawling this morose media clerk. It was an odd form of mortification for some pattern of behavior or grain of being too transparent for this ad man to fathom. This is the challenge, Duane. You have to read the mysterious current that passes in the night and connects millions of people across a continental landmass, compelling them to buy a certain product first thing in the morning. They gotta have it, and you gotta be ready for them when they show up. He said, "Package goods and painkillers. These are the things that keep the country running." A swarthy male stood in the doorway. "Jewed orange juice?" Charlie fished some money out of his pocket and paid the guy. He took an extra-strength antacid tablet out of the bottle on his desk and washed it down with a watery, pulpless, half-rancid juice for whatever accommodative effect it might have on his acidic backwash. He told a dirty joke to Duane and sensed the fellow going pink out there on the prairie. There was nothing left to do but leave. Charlie walked through the semi-swank lobby, done in Babylonian art deco, and nipped around the corner to his Swedish masseuse, who karateed his aching lumbar for 10 minutes. Then he wheeled into Brooks Brothers and picked up a couple of tennis shirts, because what's more fun than an impulse buy? He double-timed it across Madison to the men's bar at the Biltmore, where he massively inhaled a cutty on the rocks and was out the door in half a shake and skating across the vast main level of Grand Central, the Bobby Thompson baseball jammed into the pocket of his topcoat, a Burberry all-weather that he loved like a brother and that went especially well with the suit he was wearing, a slate-gray whipcord made for Charlie by a guy who did lapels for organized crime. Because he decided the ball was no longer safe in his office, and he wanted his son to have it, for better or worse. Love or money, real or fake, but please, Chucky, do not abuse my trust. I could fall down dead passing the stuffed mushrooms at dinner, and this is the one thing I want you to take and keep and care for. And he went striding through the gate just in time to make his train, which was the evolutionary climax of the whole human endeavor. And he bucketed up to the bar car, filled with people who more or less resembled Charlie, give or take a few years and a few gray hairs, and the details of their evilest dreams. The last express to Westport. Chapter 3. January 11th, 1955. There were stories about the Pope. There were reports, a certain kind of underground rumor that can make its way across a country, parish to parish. Pope Pius was having mystical visions. That was the rumor going around. He was witness to a series of supernatural events, seeing things in the dead of night. That was the story people told. I don't know, nuns, old ladies and novena knights, maybe well-heeled parishioners too, pink and fit, officers of the Knights of Columbus. People hear such a story and feel something turn in their souls, a leap out of dear old sing-song life into some other reading altogether. In class, a student mentioned the rumors to Father Paulus in the course of a discussion that touched on the subject of thaumatology, or the study of wonders. The old priest looked out the window. "If you'd been drinking Dago Red until 3 in the morning, you'd have visions, too." I went to see Father in his office later in the day. It was a 300-yard walk through a billowing white storm. I had the edges of my watch cap unfurled over my ears and kept my forearm raised against the cutting sleet, against the whole hard physical thing, the snowstorms and open spaces, the reality of a mass of land called North America, new to my experience. Father started talking before I had my jacket off. "It's when the hair in my nostrils begins going stiff. That's when I want to retire to the south of France." "The snow on the parade?" "Yes, I know."
"The benches are buried."
"Yes," he said.
"I realized, just out the window there, I was walking over a bench."
"Yes. Sit down, Shay, and tell me how you're doing. A Young Man's Progress. That's the title of this session."
"I borrowed a pair of boots."
He liked that response. "Do they fit?"
"No."
"Even better." When he asked about the state of my mind and soul, which he did only rarely, and when I answered on a practical plane, as I always did, he seemed to think I was devising a down-to-earth reply out of some manly instinct, when in fact I was only confused, forever trying to put together a suitable set of words. "What are you reading?" I recited a list. "You understand what's in those books?"
"No,"
I said. Again he smiled. I think he was tired of gifted kids. He had done work with boys of advanced standing, and now he wanted to talk to misfits of the other kind, the ones who'd made trouble for themselves and others.
"Some of it, maybe. What I don't understand, I memorize."
His arm was propped on the desk, and he leaned his head into the canted hand. No smile this time. "That's not why we started this place, is it?"
"I study like a madman, Father."
"But you can't memorize ideas the way you do endings of Latin verbs." His hands were unspotted and small. Some of the other Jebbies wore flannel shirts and heavy sweaters, but Father Paulus was not influenced by climate or geography, or the sense of special freedoms at Voyager. He went black-suited and Roman-collared, and I respected this and found it reassuring. "One of the things we want to do here is to produce serious men." "What sort of phenomenon is this?" "Not so easy to say. Someone, in the end, who develops a certain depth, a spacious quality, say, that's a form of respect for other ways of thinking and believing. Let us unnarrow the basic human tubing."
and let us help a young man toward an ethical strength that makes him decisive, that shows him precisely who he is, Shay, and how he is meant to address the world. You are always afraid of disappointing, Father, being unequal to the level of discourse, being bland when he wanted a more spirited sort of traffic, even a bullshit act, wise-ass and slouchy, bland and plodding when he wanted independence and open argument. My own life, I confess. Yes, why not? You'll hear my confession, Shay. Who better than you? It took me all these years to understand that I'm not a serious man. Too much irony. Too much vanity. Too little, what? I don't know, a lot of things. And no rage, you see? Or a small ingrown toenail rage. A puny frustration. Eventually you get to know these things. Do you act out of principle? Or do you devise self-justifying reasons for your bad behavior? This is my confession, not yours, so you're not required to come up with answers. Not yet, anyway. Eventually, yes. You'll know in your heart how well you've met the calling to be a man.
No rage, I said. What do you mean?
No rage. Rage and violence can be elements of productive tension in a soul. They can serve the fullness of one's identity. One way a man untrivializes himself is to punch another man in the mouth. I must have looked at him. You can't doubt this, can you? I don't like violence. It scares the hell out of me. But I think I see it as an expanding force in a personality. I think a man's ability to act in opposition to his tendencies in this direction can be a source of virtue, a statement of his character and forbearance.
So what do? Punch the guy in the mouth, or resist the urge?
Point well taken. I don't have the answer. You have the answer, he said. But how serious can a man be if he doesn't experience a full measure of the appetites and passions of his race? Even if only to contain them, or direct them, somehow, usefully.
Who better than you to hear me confess? He'd said that, hadn't he? Someone who's been in correction. Someone who has the answer. Of course, I had nothing that resembled an answer, and wondered why he thought I carried a stain of special knowledge for having done what I'd done.
Have you come across the word velleity? A nice Thomistic ring to it. Volition at its lowest ebb. A small thing, a wish, a tendency. If you're low-willed, you see, you end up living in the shallowest turns and bends of your own preoccupations. Are we getting anywhere?
It's your confession, Father. His office was at an old barracks building, and the force of the wind made the beams shift and crick.
Aquinas said only intense actions will strengthen a habit, not mere repetition. Intensity makes for moral accomplishment. An intense and persevering will. This is the element of seriousness. Constancy. This is an element. A sense of purpose. A self-chosen goal. Tell me I'm babbling. I'll respect you for it.
We were about 30 miles below the Canadian border in a rambling encampment that was mostly barracks and other frame structures, a harking back, maybe, to the missionary roots of the order. Except the natives, in this case, were us. Poor city kids who showed promise. Some frail-bodied types with photographic memories and a certain uncleanness about them. Those who were bright but unstable. Those who could not adjust. The ones whose adjustment was ordained by the state. A cluster of Latins from some Jesuit center in Venezuela. Smart young men with a cosmopolitan style freezing their weenies off. And a few farm boys from not so far away, shyer than borrowed suits.
Sometimes I think the education we dispense is better suited to a 50-year-old who feels he missed the point the first time around. Too many abstract ideas. Eternal verities, left and right. You'd be better served looking at your shoe and naming the parts. You in particular, Shay.
coming from the place you come from.
This seemed to animate him. He leaned across the desk and gazed, is the word, at my wet boots.
Those are ugly things, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Name the parts.
Go ahead. We're not so she-she here. We're not so intellectually chic that we can't test a student face to face. Name the parts, I said. All right. Laces.
Laces. One to each shoe. Proceed.
I lifted one foot and turned it awkwardly. Sole and heel?
Yes, go on.
I set my foot back down and stared at the boot, which seemed about as blank as a closed brown box.
Proceed, boy.
There's not much to name, is there? A front and a top.
A front and a top. You make me want to weep.
The rounded part at the front.
You're so eloquent I may have to pause to regain my composure. You've named the lace. What's the flap under the lace?
The tongue.
Well?
I knew the name. I just didn't see the thing. He made a show of draping himself across the desk, writhing slightly, as if in the midst of some dire distress.
You didn't see the thing because you don't know how to look. And you don't know how to look because you don't know the names.
He tilted his chin in high rebuke, mostly theatrical, and withdrew his body from the surface of the desk, dropping his bottom into the swivel chair and looking at me again, and then doing a decisive quarter turn and raising his right leg sufficiently so that the foot, the shoe, was posted upright at the edge of the desk. A plain, black, everyday, clerical shoe.
Okay, he said. We know about the sole and heel.
Yes.
And we've identified the tongue and lace.
Yes, I said. With his finger, he traced a strip of leather that went across the top edge of the shoe and dipped down under the lace. What is it? I said.
You tell me. What is it?
I don't know.
It's the cuff.
The cuff.
The cuff. And this stiff section over the heel? That's the counter.
That's the counter.
And this piece amidships between the cuff and the strip above the sole, that's the quarter.
The quarter, I said.
And the strip above the sole, that's the welt. Say it, boy.
The welt.
How everyday things lie hidden, because we don't know what they're called. What's the frontal area that covers the instep?
I don't know.
You don't know. It's called the vamp.
The vamp.
Say it.
The vamp. The frontal area that covers the instep. I thought I wasn't supposed to memorize.
Don't memorize ideas. And don't take us too seriously when we turn up our noses at rote learning. Rote helps build the man. You stick the lace through the what?
This I should know.
Of course you know. The perforations at either side of and above the tongue.
I can't think of the word. Eyelet.
Maybe I'll let you live after all.
The eyelets.
Yes. And the metal sheath at each end of the lace?
He flicked the thing with his middle finger. This I don't know in a million years.
The aglet.
Not in a million years.
The tag or aglet.
The aglet, I said.
And the little metal ring that reinforces the rim of the eyelet through which the aglet passes. We're doing the physics of language, eh?
The little ring.
You see it?
Yes.
This is the grommet, he said.
Oh, man.
The grommet. Learn it, know it, and love it.
I'm going out of my mind.
This is the final arcane knowledge. And when I take my shoe to the shoemaker and he places it on a form to make repairs, a block shaped like a foot, this is called a what?
I don't know.
A last.
My head is breaking apart.
Everyday things represent the most overlooked knowledge. These names are vital to your progress. Quotidian things. If they weren't important, we wouldn't use such a gorgeous Latinate word. Say it, he said.
Quotidian.
An extraordinary word that suggests the depth and reach of the commonplace.
His white collar hung loose below his Adam's apple, and the skin at his throat was going slack and ropey, and it seemed to be catching him unprepared, old age, coming late but fast. I put on my jacket.
I meant to bring along a book for you, he said.
His hands were still young, though, a soft, chalky baby blush. There was a chessboard on a table in a corner, opposing pieces marshaled.
Come to Upper Red tomorrow, and I'll dig it out for you.
Upper Red was the faculty residence. They named the buildings at Voyager after local landmarks. Lakes, towns, rivers, forests. Not after saints, theologians, or Jesuit martyrs. The Jesuits, according to Paulus, had been treated so brusquely in so many places for their attempts to convert and transform, decapitated in Japan, disemboweled in the Horn of Africa, eaten alive in North America, crucified in Siam, drawn and quartered in England, thrown into the ocean off Madagascar, that the founders of our little experimental college thought they'd spare the landscape some of the bloodier emblems of the Order's history.
By the by, Shay.
Yes, I said.
Did I see you and that little group yesterday signing a petition in support of Senator McCarthy?
I was there, yes, Father.
Signing a petition?
It seemed okay, I said. He nodded, looking past me.
Do you know why the Senate condemned him?
The others were signing, I said. Some of the South Americans. I said a little desperately, knowing how stupid this sounded, but thinking somehow this was the way to exonerate myself.
So you signed. The others were shitting, Father, so I shat.
He looked past me, nodding reasonably, and I turned and left. I walked back and forth across the parade in the blowing snow. Then I went to my room and threw off my jacket. I wanted to look up words. I took off my boots and wrung out my cap over the wash basin. I wanted to look up words. I wanted to look up velleity and quotidian and memorize the fuckers for all time. Spell them, learn them, pronounce them syllable by syllable. Vocalize, phonate, utter the sounds, say the words for all they're worth. This was the only way in the world you can escape the things that made you. October 24th, 1962. They arrived in the rain. A young crowd, except for the columnists from the Chronicle and Examiner, and a couple of gray-beard poets from City Lights. And they waited for Lenny Bruce to come out on stage. This was Basin Street West, and the small stage had a backdrop of fake fieldstone. The wall was supposed to suggest a homey atmosphere, but it resembled a mass of ugly, bulging rock, and it made the club seem dungeon-like or bunker-esque. They sat there and waited for Lenny, the jazz musicians emitting a faint reek of weed, a few monosyllabic chicks in existential black, the clean-cut college boys with secret deviant tastes, the entire staff of a little magazine called Polyester Walk, five righteous souls whose anger at the world was being undermined by the events of the past few days. Suddenly Lenny was there, without an intro, slipping into the spotlight and beginning to talk before he'd even lifted the mic from the stand.
They're evacuating Norfolk, Virginia. You know about this? Norfolk. The huge naval base where ships have been setting out, destroyers, cruisers, to form the blockade. They're evacuating dependents and all non-essential personnel. The question is...
And he turned his head sideways so he could look at the audience obliquely with a sly sense of put-on.
Who moves in when they move out? That's right, there goes the neighborhood. because all the spade undesirables from 300 miles around are going to snatch up those homes and ruin real estate values, and the Navy's going to say, fuck it, man, never mind the Russian subs and cargo ships, let's aim our guns at Norfolk.
Lenny looked a little bloated tonight. His face puff pastry white and an extracurricular jitter in his body lingo.
Everything is real estate. You're a product of your geography. If you're a Catholic from New York, you're a Jew. If you're a Jew from Butte, Montana, you're a totally goyish concoction. You're like instant mashed potatoes. And that's what this crisis is all about, incidentally. Instant mashed potatoes. The whole technology, man, of instant and quick. Because we don't have the attention span for normal wars anymore. And in the movie version, it's Rod Steiger playing Khrushchev as an actor's studio chief of state. Dig it, he's deep, he's misunderstood. He's got the accent down pat, the shaved head. He does the screaming fits, he does the motivation. Lonely boy from the coal pits ruthlessly fights his way to the top, but all he's really looking for is a wisecracking dame who'll give him some back talk and make him laugh once in a while. This is no bumpkin. Half man, half sausage. Steiger plays him as a moody and sensitive loner burdened by the whole mishigas of Russian history. We see his tender feminine side when he has an affair in a coat closet with an American double agent played by Kim Novak and a butch haircut. Lenny did the voices, the accents. He was not technically sound, but mixed in whole cultures and geographies and cross-references to convey the layers of impersonation involved. There was a beatnik element in the audience, several post-beats in old checked lumber jackets, vintage 1950. Men with a kind of distance in their gazes, but still alert to signs of marvels astir in the universe. And a woman in a patchwork shirt with a baby in a pouch, probably the first and last infant at one of Lenny's shows. But this was San Francisco in the week that was. Kennedy makes an appearance in public, and you hear people say, I saw his hair, or I saw his teeth. The spectacle's so dazzling they can't take it all in. I saw his hair. They're venerating the sacred relics while the guy's still alive.
In the beatnik canon, it was America's sickness that had produced the bomb. If the beats were receptive to Lenny's take on hypocrisy and related matters, and if they regretted his drug busts and obscenity trials, they were probably unmoved by the Russian accents and other ethnic riffs and bits that came spritzing out of them like seltzer from an old bottling plant in Canarsie. The whole beat landscape was bomb-shadowed. It always had been. The beats didn't need a missile crisis to make them think about the bomb. The bomb was their handiest reference to the moral squalor of America, the guilty place of smokestacks and robot corporations, Time Magazine and J. Edgar Hoovered, where people sat hunched over cups of coffee in 1,000 rain-swept truck stops on the Jazz Prairie, secret Trotskyites and sad nymphomaniacs with Buddhist pussies. Things Lenny made fun of. Lenny was showbiz. He was suited and groomed and cool and corrupt, the mortician comic. And the bomb was part of a scary ad campaign that had gotten out of hand. He was wearing a Nehru jacket tonight, a dark tunic with a high collar. It needed cleaning and pressing. And he had a white raincoat draped over his shoulders. Either he'd forgotten to take it off, or he was planning to get out of here in a hurry. He began an impressionistic ramble, hard to follow, about court cases, lawyers, and judges. Like listening to someone who thought he was talking to someone else. Then he broke off and said, love me. That's what I'm here for. Tonight and every night. Stop loving me, I die. This was not a bit. The bit followed this. It was a bit he'd thought up sitting in the plastic pygmy toilet on the flight from L.A. with a red light near his right eyeball flashing, return to seat, return to seat.
The Archangel Gabriel appears in the sky over Havana. Bodyguards wake up Castro and he tells them, let me alone. And they tell him it's the messenger of God. And he gets in a helicopter and goes up there. The angel's wearing a white robe and he's holding a flaming trumpet. And Castro's intrigued when he sees that Gabriel's a black man. He thinks great, an articulate Negro. We can have a real, no-bullshit dialogue. He says to the angel, I don't believe in God, but let me ask you, whose side are you on in this crisis? And the angel says, I'm only going to say this once. The side that has baseball and jazz. Castro says, we have baseball and jazz. We call it Afro-Cuban music, and you dig it, man. Swings like crazy. And Gabriel says, don't patronize me, motherfucker. I blew with Bird, you know? Yeah, we jammed together at Minton's in the old days. Okay, you want to know which side I'm on? The side that has mom and apple pie. Castro says, no problema. The Russians have mom and apple pie. They call it yablaki pirog. The angel says, okay, you're so smart. The side that has Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse, and the Mafia. And Castro says, damn, we threw the Mafia out of Cuba. But how come you're siding with them? The angel says, Lord Jesus has a soft spot for the mob. Castro says, how come? The angel says, what do you think, man? He's Italian. Castro says, wait a minute. Jesus is Italian? The angel says, well, ain't he? And he looks a little uncertain. He starts shaking the spittle off the mouthpiece of his trumpet, a thing Gabe does whenever he's insecure. He's very touchy about his education. He says a little defensively, all the popes are wops. Everybody knows this, man. This is because Jesus is a wop. Jesus is a guinea from the word go. Check his complexion, Jim. Castro says, Jesus lived in the Middle East. Gabriel says, you must be crazy telling me shit like that. The cat's Neapolitan. Talks with his hands. Castro says, he was a Jew, if you want to know the truth. The angel says, I know he was a Jew. An Italian Jew. They have them, don't they? And Castro says, why am I standing here listening to this? You're totally loco, man. And the angel says, are you telling me I believed all my life that Jesus changed water into wine at an Italian wedding, and he didn't? Lenny did this bit a little distractedly, slurring lines here and there. But isn't that what he always did? Wasn't that part of the whole hipster format, a kind of otherworldly, dope-driven fugue? I saw his hair! I saw his teeth! Then he remembered the line he'd come to love. He went into a semi-crouch and put the raincoat over his head and practically stuck the mic down his throat. We're all gonna die! Yes, he loved saying this, crying it out. It was wonderfully refreshing. It purified his fear and made it public at the same time. It was weak and sick and cowardly and powerless and pathetic. And also noble somehow. A long, loud, and feelingly high-pitched cry of grief and pain that had an element of sweet defiance. And his voice sent a weird thrill shooting through the audience. They felt the cry physically. It leaped in their blood and bonded them. This was the revolt of the psyche, an id-like wail from their own souls, the desperate, buried place where you demand recognition of primitive rights and needs. Then he gets an idea and flicks it straight out, like a boxer jabbing so well it brings a grin to his face. But maybe some of us are more powerless than others. It's a white bomb, dig? And his voice changes here, goes redneck and drawly. It's our bomb. Moscow and Washington. Think about it, man. White people control this bomb. The idea delights him. You look down at Watts, you look up at Harlem, and you say, fuck with our chicks, man, we dropped the bomb. Better end the world than mix the races. He goes into a bobster's finger-snapping slouch. Because we'd rather kill everybody than share our women. Then the lights went out. Just like that. The spotlight, the bar lights, the exit signs, all out. A vague shape, Lenny's, could be seen moving sort of experimentally toward the large metal door that opened directly onto the street, and the customers up front might have heard him muttering, return to seat, return to seat. A rustle in the audience, a few heads turning, several people standing uncertainly. Were they thinking maybe this is it? A bomb? An airburst?
Didn't the electromagnetic pulse from a test shot in the Pacific send massive currents surging through power lines in Honolulu only recently, blowing out lights and setting off burglar alarms all over the island? The lights came on. The spotlight shone on an empty stage. The fieldstone wall had never looked more naked and fake. And there was Lenny standing about a yard and a half from the exit. He came walking slowly stageward, mimicking a person sneaking back into a room, relieved and abashed. And they waited for him to say something that would pay off the long, tense moment and shake them with laughter. And he reached the stage and lifted the dangling mic and put it to his face, and it began to screech and crackle, and then the lights went out again. And the afterimage of Lenny's tallowy face stuck to every retina in the house, half a scared smirk across his mouth, and the baby started crying. When the lights came back on, a 20-second lifetime later, the stage was empty, the metal door was ajar, the show was evidently over.
This ends Disc 18.